Okay, we're going to have conversations with Linda Moulton Howe now this hour, so jump on board. But let's go back to Linda before we take our network break and let you wrap up the story about the military secret space program. Go ahead, Linda.
Yeah, and George, I just think it's important to look at our own nation's historic context in terms of presidential leadership in relationship to some of these numbers that come up in something like military space programs, NASA, Egypt, and that is this question of 33 and 333 and the significance to the Freemasons. And when you look at the history of the United States, starting with George Washington, these are the presidents confirmed as Freemasons. It does not mean it's inclusive, and I'm not going to give all 16. I'm only going to highlight a few. George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, Harry Truman, Lyndon Baines Johnson, and Gerald Ford, coming right up into sort of what we'll call the more modern era. Mm-hmm. And it is so interesting that the Freemason motto is three Latin words, Ordo ab Chao, which is order out of chaos.
Excellent. Excellent. We'll be back with Linda Moulton Howe and your questions on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, we're back with Linda Moulton Howe, Emmy Award-winning television producer and reporter, EarthFiles.com, and your phone calls, wide-ranging open lines here with Linda. So let's go to our wild card line to get things started. You're on the air with us. Hello there.
Hi, George.
Yes, sir.
Oh, hey, this is Leo from Seattle.
Hello, Leo from Seattle.
Hi. Well, I have a question for Linda related to the B story that she had been reporting on previously.
Sure.
Hi.
Hi. Well, I'm kind of phobic. I've always been scared of bees, wasps, hornets, yellow jackets, just the whole lot. And I've been particularly worried ever since I was a kid about this seemingly unstoppable northward migration of the Africanized killer bees. And what I'm wondering is if the malady that is afflicting these domestic honeybees is also afflicting the population of the Africanized killer bees.
It's my understanding that the Africanized bees have not been susceptible like the original English honeybees that have had the colony collapse disorder. So there definitely is a difference in the immunity ability of some of the bees and the fragility of some of the others. And unfortunately, the one we need the most, which is the classic honeybee, is the one that has been the most vulnerable. And even though there have been a lot of headlines about answers, the truth is that as we sit here in December of 2007, it is still kind of a potpourri of hypotheses, the last one being that virus, the Israeli virus, that they think might have come through through Australian bees into the United States. And here I'm bringing this up because this is another example. If that virus was introduced into the United States from the Australian bees that were brought in to try to beef up the honey ability for pollination and honey in the United States and carried that virus, those Australian bees were not hurt by that virus. And it underscores that we're dealing with complex immunity issues on the part of the various bees. And now the bumblebees in the United States are being affected by mysterious disappearances on both the East and the West coasts.
Okay, very good. There you go. Next up, let's go to our East of the Rockies line. Hi there.
Yes, I'm calling from Ohio. My name is Tom. I'm listening on 610 AM.
All right, Tom, you're scratchy. Linda, get a real quick question in. Go ahead.
Linda, the Knights Templar, they go up to 36 degrees or 360 degrees altogether. The Devil holds the 360th degree. And, Linda, have you also heard about the seeds from the seed crops being shipped out of the country to Norway by David Rockefeller?
Seeds being shipped out of the country. I think you know that well, Linda.
I did a story for us. Yes, I did an Earth Files report about that last spring. And this is what they're calling a Noah's Ark to try to preserve all of the cereal grain seeds and a whole huge variety of seeds. And what they hope is a temperature that will stay safe and in a rocky coast part of Denmark, so that we will have seeds no matter what happens. That's the whole idea, a Noah's Ark of seeds. And in terms of your very first statement, when we're talking about Freemasonry, the highest degree is 33. That's as high as Freemasonry goes.
Okay, thank you. Let's go to our first-time caller line. Welcome to the show. Hi there. Hello.
Hi.
Go ahead. Well, you won't be going ahead now. West of the Rockies, go ahead.
I'm from Montana.
Hi.
Hi. I thought you guys were talking about a total different topic. I was going to ask you if you were aware of what the space station out in space, when it would be, when it was projected and when the idea was began and what it was for.
Oh, well, the International Space Station, it's in an evolutionary process of building. It has been ongoing now for several years. The projection is that hopefully it will be independently functioning and operating when the so-called space shuttle program comes to an end, which is supposed to be 2010 approximately, that NASA is going to phase out the space shuttle and move to something else that's not precisely clear. But what they're trying to do is to get this whole International Space Station as complete as possible with enough scientific laboratory modules, which is what Atlantis is supposed to do on this next trip. If they get it launched Sunday, they're going to add an entirely additional science lab up there. And in a way, it's kind of a rush. Everybody is trying to get ISS into sort of a stable where the solar panels work, there's enough energy, there's enough lab space. And then what happens between the shuttles, whether it's from the United States, from Russia, or wherever, there won't be so much pressure on getting all this heavy load lifting up there. And right now, 2010 is supposed to be at least the expected cutoff on the space shuttle as we have known it.
Linda, any updates on the red dirt?
The red cells of India?
Yeah.
He said that he will email as soon as he's ready to do the scientific paper, and he has the process of submitting it now, I believe, to half a dozen journals. And the next step in our communication will be when he has this accepted for publishing about the data that he has up to right now, then he'll be able to talk about it again in even more detail than I was able to interview him just a couple of months ago.
Okay, let's go to our West of the Rockies. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there. Go ahead. Hello. Well, you're gone. East of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Yes, my name's Chris. I want to ask regarding the Freemasons.
Right.
In Laodicean and Council in 343, of course, this was after the Council of Nicaea.
Right.
And one of the canons wrote it was not lawful to receive portions, and I'm reading directly from the writings here. Sent from the feast of the Jews or heretics, nor to feast together with them. Now, a Jewish person can be a Mason. Do you think a lot of the ridicule and the suspicion against Masonry comes because it permits Jews within its membership?
Boy,
and was not also Harry Truman a Mason who also spearheaded the drive for the nation of Israel statehood?
Harry Truman is on the confirmed list of American presidents who was a Freemason. When it comes to motive and agenda and relationship between the historic Freemasonry line and what has happened in the modern times of Israel in the Middle East, you're asking an excellent question. But I think that it also goes to the heart of the squirrel's nest of our history, that no one seems to precisely understand why that Middle East has been so festering and a sore for so long, and why were the Nazis themselves so set upon annihilating the Jews, and that for us to try to understand all of those currents, I think, is still something that is challenging everyone.
Linda, I got to tell you, the mysteries that are out there are phenomenal. Yesterday, I had Stan Friedman on in Frank Fascino.
Right.
Talking about the space wars of 1952, flying saucers and our own combat planes. Man, so many things are going on, aren't they?
Exactly what I started reporting about now 4 years ago in conferences was that information that Andrew Kistner, who was a New Mexico state representative from Las Cruces, he had leaks both from White Sands employees and from a friend who was working at the Naval Research Lab. And the whole thesis was that starting at the end of the 40s with Project Paperclip, bringing Wernher von Braun and KleinConnect and all of those German rocket scientists to the United States and Project Paperclip to work down in White Sands on trying to get us up with our rocket sophistication, and that was the V-2 rocket program. And that the idea that that rocket program was... They had disks, they had white and silver disks that they were getting on film in some of those launches. That is an established historic fact, and it's established that some of those rocket launches went off. They went off 45 degrees, they went off, one went off 180 degrees. That means that we launched from White Sands, a rocket took off going south and turned around at a point down near in Mexico area, and started coming back before it crashed. Now, that was clearly what people in charge of White Sands, that's what they referred to as unusual phenomena, and that it was linked to the presence of these disks that they were actually filming, even from cameras inside of the rockets, looking out at disks that were pacing the rockets. And that is what Andrew Kistner said, that insiders told him. We began trying to attack those disks because our government said these are acting as enemies, that they are interfering with our highly classified programs, and that in those attacks, what we were not prepared for was retaliation in terms of electromagnetic grids being brought down, airplanes being brought out of the sky, and that this is apparently one of the most sensitive areas in government secrets. Not only were they retrieving technologies from crashed disks, which were then being back-engineered and going into corporations that have made billions of dollars on back-engineered extraterrestrial technology, they did not want Americans to know that we were in a secret war attacking the disk technology, losing pilots. Len Stringfield told me that in his work with Wright-Patterson Air Field, that he was told that we lost at least 2,000 pilots between the end of the 40s and the middle of the 50s trying to take disks down out of the sky. And this is, to me, one of the areas that... I think provokes me the most, that we deserve to know what our government has known and been hiding, and I do not think that people will go running to the exits. I think we just deserve to know what the truth is, and if we were attacking and retaliation was a problem and we stopped attacking, does that mean that retaliation stopped?
Good point.
And this goes, George, right to the questions of, why was there a meeting at Holloman Air Force Base in April 1964 and 10 years later? What was that glowing disk doing from 2 o'clock in the morning until 9 o'clock at night in the Sandia Hills of Albuquerque, New Mexico, witnessed by several eyewitnesses in all of those time periods? And then the military rings the 9 o'clock disk appearance as if it's an enemy.
Let's go next to our East of the Rockies line. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hello there.
Hi, George. How are you doing?
Good, sir. Take it away.
Excellent show, and I'm a longtime listener.
Thank you.
You're doing a really good justice to the show. What I wanted to ask was going back to the Freemasonry thing.
Mm-hmm.
Should we be worried that these people are they bad people? Or are they good people? Or
I don't think
so. There's so many presidents that have been Freemasons, and the Freemasons go back so many years.
Right. There's nothing in my research of history that paints the Freemasons as anything but people who tried to live up to that motto, order out of chaos, that construction and building and organization and trying to have freedom and solid government with a spiritual connection to the highest force of life, that is the essence of Freemasonry. Now, how it has gotten twisted in some areas of communication in what we'll call the end of, or at least since World War II and on, I'm not sure myself, because if you just study what the tenets of Freemasonry are about, the goals are only what all of us would like for our life, for our nation, and for our world.
Let's go west of the Rockies. You're on Coast to Coast. Hello there.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. Go ahead. Where are you calling from?
San Francisco.
Okay, sir. Go ahead.
Actually, I was wondering if how the Freemasons are linked with Bohemian Grove, because a lot of the people that she was naming earlier have been to Bohemian Grove, presidents, past presidents and stuff. Just wondering, is it every person that goes to Bohemian Grove is a Freemason, or just how does that work?
No, I don't think everyone is. Alex Jones, of course, infiltrated the Bohemian Grove, which includes a number of power brokers, elitists, and people like that. But, Linda, I don't think everyone who goes there is a Freemason.
And I think that it is very unfair to try to assume that we understand what is going on even in that Bohemian Grove unless you're in it. I mean, observing even from the outside doesn't give you insight into what is going on. And let's just set that aside, because I don't really know. I could not speak factually at all about the Bohemian Grove. All I know is what everybody else has heard as rumor and gossip and innuendo. But let's switch the track back to the astronaut program, space, and Freemasonry, because here is a fascinating fact. Astronaut Edwin Buzz Aldrin, who was there with Neil Armstrong on the moon on July 20th, 1969.
Man number two.
Took with him a Masonic flag from the Scottish Rite Temple in Washington, D.C., and conducted a Masonic ritual on the moon with that flag. I have a photograph of it in my earthfiles.com report for the Supreme Council, 33rd degree, Southern Jurisdiction, Washington, D.C. And when he got back on September 19th, 1969, on NASA stationery, Edwin Buzz Aldrin wrote to the illustrious Luther Smith, 33rd degree, Sovereign Grand Commander, Supreme Council, Southern Jurisdiction, Washington, D.C., Dear Grand Commander, it was a great, this is a quote from the letter.
How long's the quote, Linda? We got to run.
Okay,
next hour, Richard C. Hoagland's going to join us for a bit to update us on the space shuttle Atlantis, and then we will go into our special open lines. I'm going to open up a hotline as well. I'll tell you about that next hour. I witnessed an individual today who was without part of his arm, and this guy was functioning as well as anybody who has two arms. And then there was a story a few weeks ago about a farmer whose fingers got caught in his combine, and he had to saw them off to get away. Special hotline for those of you who have lost parts of your body. I want to know how it happened and how you have managed. I know that sounds a little strange for a hotline, but I am just amazed at people's abilities to just bounce back like that. And then we'll have pure open lines. Linda Moulton Howe is next, and more of your calls on Coast to Coast AM. Linda, what's your most favorite story you've ever covered? Ever.
Oh, my gosh. I think what comes to mind, it may seem odd because we're talking about really exciting breakthroughs that are beginning to emerge on the history of civilians speaking about real UFOs and military interaction and what could be in a way more exciting. But I think that the most sort of life-changing and profound, because I was doing work, was when I was in Peru for a month in June of 1987, and I went up to Cororiti, and that is high in the Andes at 22,400 feet. And it is a festival, a religious festival, that has been going on for centuries. And it's when the Incas watch for the Pleiades to go down below the horizon for a while. And when the Pleiades, who they look at as their judge and lawmaker, goes below the horizon, they go up to the mountain of Cororiti to ask for redemption from the high force so that their lives will move forward positively. And it goes on for 4 days and four nights, and there are people who beat drums nonstop for those 4 days. And what I experienced, both seeing very odd moving lights in the sky, being among people where there was, we were there on a mountain. There's no shelter. There's nothing. You are there exposed at 24 below at night, obviously in tents and in Arctic gear. But it was something where the Incas, of the 20,000 who were there, there were only about a dozen of us who were not Incan. And of the 20,000, they came in bare legs, in sandals, babies strapped to their backs, and approximately a dozen people died in exposure while I was there during those 4 days and four nights. But what I think, why it is one of the most incredible experiences that I have ever gone through and have written about it, in fact, in Glimpses of Other Realities, Volume 1, is because the link between the Incas to the life force in the universe is so strong, it's palpable, and for those 4 days and four nights, they play act in this beautiful series of dramas that never stop. The angel and the devil coming together with whips, and they whip each other, and they whip each other, and then they embrace. And I ask one of my Inca friends, why do the devil and the angel, why are they embracing? And he said, because to the Incas, it is only in the struggle and in the balance between the dark and the light that keeps the universe going.
All right. And before we take calls, wrap up with Buzz Aldrin's quote that he had on the moon.
This is from a letter, and this was discussed on page 37 in the October 1994 Scottish Rite Journal. And this letter, Richard Souter got and published in his book, Kundalini Tales, and it is signed by Edwin Aldrin, and it is to that illustrious Luther Smith, Sovereign Grand Commander of the Supreme Council in Washington, D.C., and this is the first paragraph. It was a great moment in my life to be so cordially welcomed to the House of the Temple on September 16, 1969, by you and Grand Secretary General Kleinknecht, 33 degree Mason, and also the members of your staffs. My greatest pleasure, however, was to be able to present to you on this occasion the Scottish Rite flag, which I carried on the Apollo 11 flight to the moon, emblazoned in color with the Scottish Rite double-headed eagle, the Blue Lodge emblem, and the Sovereign Grand Commander's insignia. And this is Buzz Aldrin writing to the Sovereign Grand Commander in Washington, D.C.
And back to the phones. First-time caller line, you're on with Linda Moulton Howe. Hi there.
Hi, my name's Roy. I'm from Manchester, New Hampshire.
Thank you, Roy.
I wanted to ask her a couple of questions real quickly about Loring Air Force Base in Limestone, Maine. I'm from northern Maine originally, and I've seen many strange sights in there. It's right next to the Canadian border, and I don't know why. And now I'm starting to realize that perhaps they were doing experimentation at that base, and they shut it down back in the late 80s, you know, like 89 or 90.
Do you know what they were experimenting with specifically?
I'm sure it was high tech. I mean, and it was during the 73, when I was like about 10 years old, I saw a bright light go across the sky during midday, and I blame it now on space debris, but I'm not positive. But of course, NASA, I don't believe NASA would tell you.
So, yeah, that's right. And no, I doubt that it was space debris. Around air bases, and Loring has been, if you go back 40, 50 years in UFO reports and literature, Loring Air Force Base is one of those places where there have been so many reports of UFOs. But so is Kirtland Air Force Base, and you can go around the country and you can say, okay, if I step back from this picture and I try to see a pattern, what is the pattern? And the pattern is that the entire UFO disc technology phenomenon has always seemed to be focused around areas where there were nuclear missiles, nuclear power plants, military bases, for sure, military bases. And again, this is the big question that a lot of us are trying to understand. Once upon a time is no, I don't think there's any doubt. We were in an attack mode with the DIS technology, and our military leaders were defining them as enemy technology. And then, if Len Stringfield is correct, and we lost 2,000 pilots trying to take discs out of the sky, and we switched our entire approach, what is the relationship of the United States government this very day to not just one, because it's very clear that there are several types and perhaps several agendas, but they are not human. And our government has some kind of relationship or relationships with this presence, and they've had a policy from at least Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Truman on that none of us were ever to know, because that would upset the national security. And this is where we get into it's another whole show, it could go on for hours, about what the United States has become in the quote-unquote policies of denials on so many levels in the interest of national security being used as a kind of general Vaseline for everything that this government wants to cover up, and that what I'm encouraged by are more and more civilians and military people like Paul McKeever and like Thomas Coleman Shepard earlier this year from the Navy who are frustrated, and now they feel like that they can tell their stories and that it is past time for the government to level with us about what it knows. So I'm not surprised at all that in the Loring Air Force Base in Maine that you might have seen discs day and night.
Okay, let's go to our wildcard line. You're on Coast to Coast with Linda Moulton Howe. Hi there.
Hi, George. How are you doing? Linda, it's Bob.
Good.
From Burbank.
Hey, Bob.
Hey, Linda, I've worked as a contractor for LTV Aerospace and some other contractors where we do, everything's compartmentalized, as you know. We used to build satellites and stuff. But talking to people, I've learned interesting things about, you know, UFO since topics like 70
right.
years old. And what I learned, something you have to really take seriously and really confirm with some of your contacts, that in fact there's a secret budget in the United States government to do this. If a UFO, this started back in 1948, I believe, and if someone takes photographs or videotapes or too many people see in a UFO event, like a saucer, the government has a program where they actually manufacture that exact same saucer, and then they have the media videotape, put it on TV and say, hey, look, that was us. They did that with the Avro car.
Huh, that's right. True. They did that with that.
Yes.
Yeah, and the only reason they did that is they just hovered it, that was it, they canceled it. They did another thing, a family videotaped in their backyard a giant, like a pyramidal shaped UFO landed in the backyard. They videotaped this thing with aliens running around, and it got all over the internet. And then the government got a multi-$100 million contract to build it. It was the company that built it was McDonnell Douglas, and they called that the Delta Clipper. And what they did is they had this huge, almost two-story pyramid that had rocket engines, and they floated in the air and videotaped it, put it all over TV, and they said, guess what? The video on the internet, that's us. And they've been washed, and it's called cleaning. They wash evidence that way. And I'm sure you're aware of that, Linda, correct?
You are not the only person who has told me about these, I think another word they use is dry cleaning up, that if something has emerged exactly as you have said in the UFO phenomenon, that our government will make what it looks like based on drawings and get somebody in the media to document it as ours, and then they think that they have squashed that one, when in fact it's very clear not our government, not Russia, not England, not Australia, not China, not India can make a 1.8-mile long triangle that can be stationary in the air, as was seen by many people over Phoenix on March 13th, 1997.
Nope, you got that right, Linda. Wildcard line number two, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Oh, hi. This is Pat from Bloomington.
Hey, Pat, go ahead.
Hi. Yes, I think Linda's on a hot thread there, because I just saw a story on YouTube, which was off a cable show about the Mexican Roswell.
Mm-hmm.
And it basically was in 1974, and it was the same shape UFO as she describes in Albuquerque. And what happened was there was a plane that went south to Mexico, and it actually collided with this UFO. And the United States Army, or I'm not sure, Air Force, went south and picked it up.
Yes, on its truck. This is Coyame, Mexico. It is about 90 miles south of El Paso, Texas. And this is a very important case for this reason, and you're right. It happened in September of 74, not long after the May 74 events in Kirtland. And here is the bottom line from what has been leaked. I cannot say this is absolute hard provable fact, but this is what has been leaked, that the Central Intelligence Agency was all over that collision between the small plane and a disc, and that our government went formally and officially in the beginning through the executive wing in the State Department to Mexico and said that we wanted to go into Coyame and help retrieve the whatever they were calling it, plane crash or whatever. And Mexico said no. And now the CIA moved up to satellites because the Mexican army started with a convoy to go to retrieve whatever was there. And we switched up to satellites, watching every foot of this Mexico convoy, and it was a disc, and there were bodies, and there were non-human bodies. And while they were observing from satellites, suddenly, the convoy stops. This is the alleged story. Doors open. The CIA doesn't know what's happening. They get in one of their Project Moondust or Pounce teams very quickly because they know that they're dealing with a disc technology that is not from Earth. And when they get there, they find that every single military person in the Mexico convoy is dead, but not dead by physical attack or guns, just dead. And that the story is that every single thing was burned at that site, including the Mexican military bodies, because of the fear of the spread, and this is the dot, dot, dot. Was it disease? Was it an alien virus? And for those of you who have heard me report about the Majestic 12 documents that have been leaked through Bob and Ryan Wood, that there is a section in both the Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit document and in what is called the Majestic 12 White Hot document that says between July 2nd and July 5th, 1947, at a landing zone 1 between Corona and Roswell, at a landing zone 2 at the Trinity site on the northern end of White Sands, and landing zone 3, 30 miles east of Alamogordo, were wedge-shaped, not circular, not spherical, not cylindrical, but wedge-shaped craft. And in the one between Corona and Roswell, what the horrible secret is supposed to be, it says they found bodies dissected as one would a frog. That's landing zone 1. Landing zone 2, they found inside of landing zone 2 craft animal parts in containers. And that in those three crashes with bodies, that a security team out of Los Alamos came from Los Alamos National Lab to try to deal with one of those or both of landing zone 1 and 2. And that the result was that all of the security team died within 24 hours from hemorrhaging. And that it goes on in those documents to say about the concern of a lethal alien virus. Well, now, should any of us be terrified by this information? I don't think so. We're here. The Earth has gone a long ways from 1947. But what all this is important and why Coyame in Mexico is so important, if this is true, then the danger of coming up against non-human bodies and entities may be something that the government caught on to, and that one of the reasons why they have been so concerned about whether or not there would be an interface between the public and the non-humans might have something to do with disease. But we don't know the hard facts. We do know the CIA went into Mexico, went to Coyame, allegedly took that disc to Atlanta. And what is in Atlanta? The Centers for Disease Control.
Very good. Linda, we're not going to have enough time. Tell us about what's up sometime in January. Are you working on anything specifically for us?
Well, what I hope, and first of all, I guess I should say Merry Christmas and Happy Holidays to you and all of our listeners. I love being able to share with you all, and that it's hard to believe that January 1, 2008 is just around the corner.
I can't wait.
With a ticking, we're going to have Solar Max starting, and that 2012 date hangs out there, and there are so many things happening. But what I hope is that out of all of this reporting, maybe somebody is listening tonight who was there in Albuquerque on May 28, 1974, either in the military ringing that disc, or you were one of those civilians in one of those cars or on one of those trails. And if so, please, please email me at earthfiles@earthfiles.com. And in January, I will come back with whatever is the latest that I can report about the extraordinary, emerging, hard testimony of people who dealt with this.
Thank you, Linda. Merry Christmas to you, my dear. Richard C. Hoagland up next for a quick shuttle update before we go into open line.